This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. On today's episode, we're exploring the fascinating world of reproductive technology and the potential impact that artificial wombs could have on society. Our host is physicist and broadcaster Helen Chersky. Here's Helen with more.
Today, we are looking at how technology forces ethics to take a big, long look in the mirror with a topic that sounds a bit like science fiction, and that is artificial wombs. These don't exist today for humans, but perhaps it's time to start thinking about what would happen if they did exist, because the technology is creeping ever closer to reality. And we tend to assume that technology is going to solve our problems, but the challenge posed by Claire Horn in her new book, Eve, The Disobedient Future of Birth, is that maybe we need to solve our problems before we jump on board with new technologies. Claire Horn is a research fellow at Dalhousie University's Health Law Institute, and she has spent a lot of time researching these issues. And Claire, welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks so much.
So let's just start just a little bit with you. So how did you come to this topic? Because this is, it's obviously a really important topic, but it's also, it's not the sort of thing you trip over every day, perhaps. How did you come to thinking about reproductive ethics?
Well, it's a great way of putting it. So my journey into this topic began about 7 years ago. I was at the very beginning of my PhD in law, and I knew that I was going to focus on issues around reproductive rights and justice. And I was getting stuck in to reading some general articles about issues in the field when I came across this word ectogenesis, external gestation. And I learned that there was actually scientific research that was happening orientated towards artificial wombs. And I just found, as a legal scholar, that this technology presented so many fascinating ethical and legal and social issues that I kind of couldn't keep away from it. And in the end, this is what I focused on in my PhD research as well. So I've been working on it for quite some time now.
Now, you mentioned one of the words already. There's always a little bit of jargon in these things, but ectogenesis really does sound like something out of a sci-fi film. But there's a few words. There's ectogenesis, external gestation, and then this thing biobag. So just very quickly run us through what the words are, and then we'll get to what the technology is.
Ectogenesis is actually a word that was coined in the 1920s by the scientist and author J.B.S. Haldane at a conference in Cambridge. And ectogenesis literally means external gestation. So I'll take those together, ectogenesis and external gestation. That refers to the growth of a baby outside of the human body. As to this word biobag refers specifically to a research project that began in 2017. It was a group of researchers at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that created what is essentially a life support platform for extremely preterm babies. And it's referred to as a biobag initially, because the way that it worked, it looks like a bag. It's basically a clear plastic bag filled with artificial amniotic fluid in which a fetus is suspended. And this technology was trialed on extremely premature lamb fetuses. And the intent there was essentially to bridge the point between which a fetus has very little chance of survival, around 22 weeks, the equivalent of 22 weeks in a human, through to about the equivalent of 28 weeks in a human, when the body of that lamb is significantly more developed to allow it to survive in the outside world.
Now, there's this really interesting thing about this technology, because I think, you know, when you hear someone say those things, you kind of assume that the way this might work is that someone starts at the beginning at conception and kind of moves forwards from there. But actually, what you describe in your book is that this technology is moving backwards, that it kind of starts from the moment of birth and it's moving backwards in time. Just describe to us how that works and where might this go? What potential has it got?
So there's two areas where we're seeing research on external gestation occur. The first involves technologies like the biobag. So these, again, are total life support systems for extremely premature babies, and they work by replicating the environment of the uterus to allow an extremely preterm baby to continue to develop as though it had not yet been born. And this is really quite remarkable because they're different from the existing technologies that we have, in that the existing technologies treat the complications of preterm birth, whereas these new technologies are intended to prevent those complications from arising to begin with by extending the period of gestation. At the other end of gestation, we also have research with human embryos. So scientists are getting further and further in growing, cultivating human embryos outside the body. And we've also seen really interesting research with animals. So recently, there was a group working in Israel that was able to grow mice into fetuses with fully formed organs using a mechanical artificial womb.
And perhaps we should make a sort of distinction here, because at the moment, people might be used to hearing about incubators, for example, when you get a premature baby who is perhaps 6 to 8 weeks premature, and they're not as well developed as they might be, but you can put them in a warm place and you can kind of feed them externally. And they're in the air, basically. But there's this point where this process, if you go back, it needs to be in liquid. Just describe that transition for us.
Really, the big challenge with preterm babies is that none of their organs are sufficiently developed to survive in the outside air. And one of the key issues is around the development of these infants, their lungs, because they lack what's called surfactant, which is the sticky substance that's on the surface of the lungs that allows them to stay open. So breathing air is really quite problematic for the extremely preterm baby. Whereas if you can gestate these babies in a liquid environment, you can allow those really, really underdeveloped organs to continue to grow.
And of course, this is not simple. Like, you know, it's one of those sci-fi things where you can kind of use a word and it sort of conjures up these sci-fi films where you've got, I don't know, you know, hospitals with rows and rows of these things. But actually, there are a huge number of complications. You know, pregnancy is a complicated process and we don't understand how all of it works, and you have to replicate all of this. And so I just wanted to pick up on the point about the sort of broad ethics of experimentation on this, because obviously, you know, we have experimentation in animals, as you described with lamb fetuses. But fundamentally, if you ever want to do this with humans, you're going to have to do some experimental work. How does that work? How do the ethics of that work in this case, in developing the technology?
Yeah, so in Eve, I get quite in depth about some of the ethical questions that are posed by artificial wombs in terms of these trials, because as you point out, this inevitably is going to involve trials with pregnant people and extremely premature babies. And effectively, you need to be able to show that this technology is going to be so much more beneficial for the extremely premature baby than the technology that already exists. I also get into some of these questions of how you kind of address issues around the informed consent of the pregnant person. Because of course, ultimately in the first instance, these are technologies that are being used in circumstances where there is an extremely prematurely born baby involved, which is likely to be a traumatic situation for the pregnant person as well. So that presents some pretty significant issues. And I know that at least one of the scientific research teams that's working on these technologies has noted that they would likely work towards trials in the instances where a preterm birth could be anticipated and a baby could be delivered by cesarean section.
So the idea, I mean, the sort of, I guess the reason you have written the book now is that it's technology in all spheres is advancing very quickly. But in this case, the technology is starting to get to the point where there are kind of new questions. It's not just a case of we have an incubator and we're making incubator technology better. There's a step change. And you think this might happen in the next few years. Like, what's your perception? You're obviously not a scientist working on the technology, but what's your perception of really when might we have to face up to questions about what we do with these new technologies?
I'm very glad that you raised that point, because I am indeed not a scientist. I'm a legal scholar. So I don't want to speak for any of the contemporary research teams. But I know that based on current estimates, it's likely that we will see an artificial womb as a form of life support for preterm babies introduced within our lifetime. These technologies are likely to move to preclinical or clinical trials with human infants, probably within the next 10 years. That is possible. And then in terms of these issues further down the line, I think we all understand at this kind of stage in human history that technological and scientific advancements tend to really outpace the cultural conversation as well as our regulatory frameworks. And so I wrote Eve because I do think that it's time to start having a conversation about some of those novel ethical challenges.
Well, it was interesting because by the time I got to the end of the book, I kind of looking at it the other way around. I mean, I came out of it thinking that actually, in a way, what you're doing is you're laying out all the difficulties of reproductive ethics. And you're saying these are based on assumptions. We've kind of got to some kind of general agreement about what we think is acceptable or not, but it is entirely based on assumptions about what technology makes possible. And if you add a new technology, then these kind of ethical balances, you know, then they may not stay where they are, and there may be pressure to move them. Is that fair? Is a fair description of what the book is?
I think that's fair. I think, you know, my position in Eve, because I've been working on this topic for such a long time, you know, you say artificial womb or ectogenesis, and people get either really excited or really scared. There's this impulse to go to these dystopian, Brave New World style futures, or to start kind of spinning out these utopian visions of communal care, you know, these babies grown in artificial wombs where we all collectively share responsibility for their lives and their futures. And Eve is very much about kind of trying to reground the conversation in contemporary social issues, because the fundamental argument of the book is that technology doesn't solve social problems, and that artificial wombs will only be as advanced as the societies into which they arrive. And I think when it comes to a whole slew of issues around reproductive rights, we have a really long way to go.
Well, let's get into some of those rights. And they are, I mean, as you write, I mean, they're clearly all linked, and there are some common themes that go through, but then there are these quite separate ideas. So I guess we should probably start at the beginning with IVF, because that was, I mean, in terms of having babies, there's no doubt there was a huge step there when something manipulated became part of the process. And one of the things that I was not aware of, and I'm very glad that you made me aware of it, was that in the West, we talk about reproductive rights as, you know, as relating to IVF, but you say because that was a white women's agenda. It wasn't an agenda of all women. It was an agenda of white privileged women. And it's really interesting that even back there, right at the beginning, really, of these conversations about how we do this, there was an inequity.
In the book, I should say that I'm really informed by concepts from the reproductive justice framework. And this is a framework that was developed by Black feminist grassroots organizers in the United States that really tries to frame the questions of reproduction, not around rights, so not around limited choices, such as the right to continue or end a pregnancy, but around broader issues of social justice. So the reproductive justice framework emphasizes the right to have or not have a child, the right to raise families in safe, healthy environments, the right to access the forms of care that are acceptable to people on their own terms. And as you say, much of the early organizing around reproductive rights, including both organizing around abortion and later around access to technologies like IVF, really centered a kind of privileged white woman for whom many basic forms of care in reproduction could be assumed to be stable. And so IVF then was framed as a kind of new additional choice beyond and above access to choices like seeking birth control or like seeking sufficient care during pregnancy.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And so, but the contrast was that in other communities, you know, there's this, you know, these historic problems of undervaluing minority communities, of either not caring for them or, you know, in some, there is a horrendous history of forced sterilization, for example. So control over even being able to have a baby. And so I think, I mean, your point, it seems, is that you can't see, here's a technology. It's always adding something, is that there's a broader context, which is, let's step back and actually look at who benefits from this and why they're benefiting and why other people might not benefit.
That's exactly right. And so this important history that you mention around sterilization, this is an issue that I delve into in Eve, because we do still live in a world where for many people, there is a danger of their state controlling, attempting to step in and control their access to being able to continue a wanted pregnancy. So I'm speaking to you from Canada, and even as recently as a few years ago, there were cases involving Indigenous women being subjected to sterilization in Canadian hospitals under the threat of not being able to see their newborn babies. And so I think when we talk about technologies like the artificial womb, as you say, we kind of need to move away from this assumption that it's inevitably a technology that could just add benefits to our society. We also really need to look at the ways that in our existing society, in the absence of this technology, many people are not given sufficient access to choose to continue their pregnancies on their own terms.
As is obvious, I guess, from the description of this technology, it's extremely expensive, it's complicated, it involves a lot of people, of nurses, of people to it. You know, it's not just like you sort of put something in a bag and, you know, come back 9 months later. There's a whole question of affordability and accessibility. And so I'm kind of interested. I recognize, you know, your job is to take an impartial view, but it almost sounds sometimes as though in the book you wish that people would stop pushing all this money into new technology when they could just spend some of that money sorting out these really basic problems. Is it as simple as, you know, it's one or the other? Or is it a case that you just have to accept everything's happening at once and move forward together?
I think that you're right. I appreciate that you heard in the book that I do wish that we would stop diverting so many resources to new technologies when there are really significant issues of equity and justice that don't require technological investment. They require social focus and funding. So for instance, in the book, I talk about how the vast majority of preterm births, as well as complications from those preterm births, happen in low-income nations. And this is not as a result of a lack of technology. It's as a result of really inequitable distribution of basic resources like antibiotics and like culturally safe and appropriate midwifery care. And so certainly I think that there is this issue of turning focus to technological solutions when focus would be better placed on social solutions. Having said that, it's also true that technologies are moving at pace. That's not changing. And in a lot of cases, these technologies have already been funded. So then it becomes a different kind of conversation about, okay, what are some of the issues that we could draw to the fore, given that these technologies are going to be happening no matter what?
Now, the middle part of your book, and I hesitate to say this because it's a great book, but some of the topics in the middle part of it are really horrible. And I think part of your point, is that that's necessary, right? Is that actually everyone wants to think the best of everyone and everyone wants to think the best of the world. And actually, if you look at history, the lessons from history are we can't rely on people just to do nice things, you know, and to be inclusive and all of these things. And so I want to just discuss a little bit eugenics, because you do talk about this. And I think you've got perhaps a broader definition of eugenics than people out on the street might be used to, because, you know, when we think of eugenics, certainly in the UK, we think of, you know, Francis Galton and, you know, the early 1900s and these periods where people are talking about we want a superior white race and we're going to, you know, aim for that in a very specific way. We're going to breed humans. But your definition of eugenics is broader and it very specifically relates to the artificial womb. So just talk us through that.
So the way that I define eugenics and the way that I think about it and analyze it in the book is that eugenics is any policy in place by a state or an institution with power that is oriented towards discouraging the reproduction of particular groups or encouraging the reproduction of others. And that relationship between artificial wombs and eugenics actually begins at that conference in Cambridge where J.B.S. Haldane coined the word ectogenesis, because he did so in the context of kicking off this interesting debate between a number of authors and scientists and thinkers at the time about technologies of the future, including artificial wombs. And this discussion happened very much structured around the argument that artificial wombs could be used to create what they refer to as better humans. And so it was very much developed in the kind of crux and midst of how would we use artificial wombs for eugenics. And the question that I pose in that passage of the book is, if this technology was introduced into our society today, could we be certain that it would not be used to control who was and was not allowed to reproduce?
And of course, that control comes indirectly as well as directly. It's not necessarily that you have to have a sort of application form to fill in. It's things like access and affordability and a whole load of indirect things that can push a choice, can push what happens, even though someone may not have written a policy that says we are doing this. I mean, you're talking about really insidious things here.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think that this is also what often allows us to imagine that we no longer live in a society where eugenics is at the fore, is that it's often the kind of practice that has become more insidious than simply a law or policy that specifically says this group of people should not be allowed to have children. It's immersed into medical practice and to social practices in a really different kind of way.
Well, let's carry on with the. It's a really interesting book, but I think that your point is that since human babies are seen as such a joyful thing and, you know, a good thing in society, maybe the only way you can approach these things is from what happens when things don't go as intended or go slightly wrong. So I'd like to pick up on the question of abortion, because you make this point that there is a dehumanizing point of view in the abortion debate that just sees women as an incubator. You know, your job, love, is to sit over there, grow the baby, and that's what you're going to do. And that's your role in the process, that you're just the kind of machine that makes this happen. And this is relevant to abortion because some people, there is a debate, I guess. There are people who think that artificial wombs might be relevant to the abortion debate, which I would have thought those, before I read this book, those two things were a long way apart, but apparently they're not. So what are the future dangers that you see here?
I guess I would just start by kind of taking you through where that idea comes from, that relationship between abortion and artificial wombs. And in fact, you know, when you asked me how I came to this topic, right around that time that I first came across the word ectogenesis, I just thought there are so many fascinating social issues that could arise around this technology. And what I found was that again and again, as I read through the legal and bioethical literature, I was just coming across the same argument, which is this claim that abortion is protected because pregnancy involves a person's body. So it would undermine their autonomy to force them to be pregnant against their will. But that if we had an artificial womb, people could be made to have unwanted pregnancies transferred into the technology to continue to grow rather than seeking a termination of pregnancy. And in Eve, I really delve into all of the reasons why I find this claim incredibly anti-feminist. And I think it really fails to understand what people are actually seeking when they seek an abortion. And of course, it also presents a lot of practical issues. For example, what exactly would be happening to these unwanted fetuses growing in artificial wombs?
And who would look after them when they grow up and all that? You know, it's a very mechanical view of the world, as you say. And I mean, how is your feeling about the big serious topics? Do you feel that they are, you know, that if we just think about them a bit, we will be able to avoid them? Or is it your feeling that, you know, we're kind of headed for some really real, you know, real life bad outcomes in how this is arranged if we don't take this head on? I mean, is it a case of we're sliding into things that might not go well, or we're actually looking at a tool that might take a lot of reproductive rights away from women in the near future?
I think that context is incredibly important here. And I want to be careful because I also think that, you know, a technology that could help save the lives of wanted, extremely preterm babies, and that also could be used for pregnant people in instances where pregnancies become dangerous to them, I think that that technology in and of itself is not a bad thing. And I think that the reason that I raise context is, for instance, artificial wombs were actually explicitly referenced in Dobbs, which was the court case that brought down Roe v. Wade, the protections to abortion in the United States. I think if we look at what's been happening for a long time in the US context, I definitely do have concerns about how this technology could be mobilized. I think in any place where abortion is still treated as an issue for criminal law, where the fetus's potential for life is weighted against the pregnant person's rights, there is a danger there. But then there is a contrast. So for instance, in Canada, there isn't a criminal law on abortion. Abortion is really, to a large extent, treated as a vital medical service. And in that way, there isn't this conflict between a life-saving technology for a wanted preterm baby and a person's reproductive rights.
And one of the things that you come to at the end of the book, I guess, that is perhaps something that does sound like something out of a science fiction book, you know, that is set 300 years in the future, which is the relationship of the artificial womb to feminism and to the search for a way of organizing the world where there's genuine equality when you have a biological event that works differently for different people. How, and I guess there's an extreme point of view there that says labor, the process of pregnancy and birth is a lot of effort, it's work, it's physically very demanding. And it might be something, you know, perhaps comparing it to the washing up and washing clothes and, you know, those sorts of things. It might just be outsourced to a technology, which obviously has implications for what it means to be human. Is that an active debate? I mean, is there a lot of feminist debate about this? Or is that something that you explored because it's a relevant issue, but we're not quite discussing it yet?
So there's such an interesting and long-standing body of feminist literature about this very subject. So going all the way back to those discussions in the 1920s, in fact, Vera Brittain, the nurse and the novelist, was in the thick of those debates that were mostly among men at the time. And she was making the point that, yeah, maybe someday artificial wombs would be initially appealing to women because pregnancy and birth are hard and they're forms of work. But then ultimately, we would realize that there is this really important relationship that's happening when a person gestates a baby. And how do we know that these babies would turn out the same way as babies that were carried by a person? And in the 1970s, you also have Shulamith Firestone, who's arguing the other point, basically saying pregnancy and birth have all of these really intense physical, social, emotional consequences for women. It falls disproportionately on women in society. And if we had this technology, perhaps we could create a more equitable world. And I think what is compelling to me about this feminist literature is that it's really driving home that people do need better access to reproductive care. We still are in a situation where there is not enough scientific research and investment in complications that face people during their pregnancies, in the kinds of injuries that can occur during birth. And I think that there is a kind of provocation in that feminist literature that I find really compelling because it's demanding that we take those issues seriously, essentially saying, if we don't address this, then maybe our best option is creating this technology. Again, the position that I take in the book is that technology does not solve social problems, but I think even thinking through those provocations maybe does something valuable.
Well, I guess that's also what science fiction books do. They let you explore what different futures might be like, so you're better able to think about them. Now, one of the things you're quite open about in the book, and you discuss it towards the end, is that as this was going on, you yourself were gestating for the first time. And so it sounds as though the writing of the book, pretty much you carried a baby and you carried a book at the same time, pretty much. Do you think you would have written the same book if you had written it the year before?
Wow, what a wonderful question. You know, I think that being pregnant over the course of writing the book, and you're absolutely right that the course of the pregnancy tracked with the life of the book. And I handed over the final draft to my publisher, and then my baby arrived almost exactly a week later. So they really sort of came into the world at the same time, too, in a sense. And I think that one of the things that I thought about very deeply because I was pregnant was that relationship that occurs when you are gestating. So again, going back to this point that there are aspects of human gestation that likely cannot be replicated. And there is an important distinction to be made between something that is external gestation and pregnancy. A pregnancy is something that animals do, and those are different things. So I think that I was probably more maybe attuned to that than I might have been had I not been pregnant at the time. But then in terms of the other issues that I delve into around inequality and access to reproductive care and around reproductive rights, I think the pregnancy just kind of reinforced how strongly I felt about those things. Because, for instance, I was very aware of how it would feel so different if I didn't want to be pregnant. All of those challenges that you face when you are pregnant, how much more deeply difficult they would be if you encountered them and you were pregnant against your wishes.
There are examples in science, a very small number, but they do exist, mostly in the sphere of gene editing, where scientists themselves actually have said, no, we're not going to do this. And the most recent example, although it was shortly after broken briefly, was, you know, basically a moratorium on gene editing humans that where the genetic changes would then be propagated. And scientists said, self-censored in a way, they said, no, we do not think this is acceptable. If this happens, it should be society's decision, and therefore we will stop this science. Do you think that there is any move towards anything like that among the scientists who are working on these technologies? Are they working on this to improve the chances for wanted babies who are born very prematurely, or are they doing this because they think, you know, one of these sort of science fiction futures might be reality. Like, do you think there's a point where they would say, this is not the right thing to do, or it's certainly not our decision about whether we keep on developing it?
I think I would say, so again, I want to be careful not to put words in anyone's mouth, but I would say I really feel for the scientists that are working on these total life support platforms for preterm babies, because I do think that from what I have read of their positions, they're really trying to emphasize, they're not trying to replicate pregnancy here. They're not trying to really drastically lower the threshold at which an extremely preterm baby can survive. They have a specific target, which is to help support these prematurely born babies. Having said that, there are instances from the history of science from really not that long ago where you have some scientists that are kind of eagerly writing about their intent to work towards ectogenesis, who then face pretty strong social censure for that position. And I think that there are likely a lot of scientists out there that are doing work with embryos, and this certainly tracks with what I've read of the researchers that are currently studying the growth of embryos outside the body. A lot of those scientists are very clear that they understand that there are social implications of this research, and that really how it goes in the future is a question for society, not for science alone.
And finally, we're almost at the end of the time that we have, but I'm interested, and the book as we record this has only been out for, I think, 3 weeks, but I'm interested in the reaction you've had to it so far. Has it been a surprise to people? Have people been shocked by it? What's the feeling you get back from the people who have read it?
There's a real mix. I think there's some people that are absolutely shocked or horrified or excited, having not thought about the possibility of artificial wombs. And then I've also had the experience of other people that have read it and just sort of said, yeah, I knew this was coming. So it's a kind of interesting mix.
I mean, difficult ethical topics have those characteristics, right? So we are out of time. We've only touched on a tiny fraction of all the things you wrote about. It's a very broad synthesis, I think, of a lot of issues. I highly recommend that anyone listening to this finds a copy and reads it. It will change your view of a lot of things, I think, in a really valuable way. So Claire, thank you so much for joining us. That was Claire Horn. Her new book, Eve, The Disobedient Future of Birth, is available now. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. I'm Helen Chersky. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over 2 decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.